The following podcast is a presentation of Reasons for Faith International Ministries, home of the program Truth to Live By. This is Dr. Miguel Gonzalez, and I want to thank you for joining us for today's podcast. Our last podcast marked the start of a brand new series entitled An Introduction to the Essential Doctrines of Christianity. During this series, we will look at and explain nine of the major doctrines of the Christian faith. But before we get to the first doctrine we will cover, I was going to look at three topics that, in my opinion, are foundational for this series. During our last podcast, we started discussing truth. We considered two definitions, one by a world-renowned relative, be itself untrue and relative. It is a self-refuting and circular argument to say that there is no absolute truth by insisting that relativism is absolutely true is illogical and defies all common sense. The second issue is that truth must have, by definition, something fixed and absolute by which to correspond in the real world. If, according to relativists, truth is relative, then truth must be relative to something else. The question is, what is it relative to? Well, it ends up being relative to the relative to the relative, and so on, with no end to what it's relative to. The problem with that is that if there is nothing in the real world for a person's view of relativism to correspond with, there's no test to see whether it is true. At some stage, it has to point to something that is not relative to prove its truthfulness. But since it can't, then relativism cannot be true. In writing about relativism, Rick Cornish states that in these postmodern days, I quote, truth is no longer considered the same for all persons at all times in all places. Pick your own truth. One version is as good as the next, close quote. He's absolutely right. Ironically, and without realizing it, every time a relativist says there's no such thing as absolute truth, for that moment he has stopped being a relativist because for that moment he has believed in absolute truth. Every time they argue their position, they are arguing it from an absolute truth position, a position that they argue doesn't exist. The next philosophy about truth that we will consider is subjectivism. Now, this argument states that if you hope to ever discover truth, you must rely on your own feelings and emotions to do so. In other words, if it feels right, if it feels good, then it must be true. Again, there are several problems with this philosophy as well. First of all, feelings and emotions are constantly changing. How can we possibly make them the test by which we determine whether something is true or not? If truth is subjective, then truth would be continually changing since our feelings and emotions are continually changing. Just think about how ludicrous that would be. Think of how often we would have to change our minds about any given thing in a week's time. Many certainties, such as the law of gravity or the law of thermodynamics, would have to be revised often depending on how a given scientist feels. Why bother printing textbooks? After all, the author's feelings and emotions may change a month after the book has been published, requiring it to be recalled and rewritten again and again. A second problem is, what if a lecturer made a statement in an auditorium full of people, and hundreds of people felt differently about the statement he made? Whose feelings are right? According to subjectivism, the only conclusion we can reach is only to him and those who feel the same way he does, even though the statement may be objectively true. So according to subjectivists, there's no such thing as objective truth. Can you imagine the nightmare that that scenario creates? They deny something we all, either consciously or unconsciously, know to be true. Not that objective truth can exist, but that it does. The point is, nothing could ever be true if truth is determined by our feelings, emotions, and intuition. Here's a third concern. We all know that bad news can be true. Or is it? And if truth is only what makes us feel good, then all bad news must be untrue. I suppose then the next time someone's boss tells the person he is being laid off or fired from his job, he should dismiss it as a false statement and still show up to work the next day as if nothing had happened. Absolutely insane. Norm Geisler states, quote, "In short, feelings can be a result of a reaction to truth, not the basis of truth," close quote. Rick Cornish states, and I quote, "As with all good things, emotions must be kept in proper context. But in much of our culture, our feelings overstep our God-intended bounds because we rank them over reason. Emotions cannot determine truth or decide right from wrong. Feeling good does not suggest that something is true, and feeling bad does not indicate it's false. Emotions contain no content, no information by which to evaluate truth or falsehood. Our reasoning capacity performs that function. Emotions are the part of the soul that appreciates and responds to life, expecting them to identify truth. It's like asking our ears to smell a flower. They can't, because ears weren't made for smelling," close quote. Our next philosophy about truth is pluralism. In writing about pluralism, Os Guinness stated, and I quote, "There is no truth, only truths. There is no grand reason, only reasons. There is no privileged civilization or culture, beliefs, norms, and styles. Only a multiplicity of cultures, beliefs, periods, and styles. There's no universal justice, only interests and the competition of interest groups. There's no grand narrative of human progress, only countless stories of where people and their cultures are now," close quote. Alan Mosley, in his book Thinking Against the Grain, states, and I quote, "Pluralism is the cultural doctrine that each community's ideology or religion is equally legitimate or true. Therefore, no idea or system of morality can lay claim to a higher authority. All philosophies are on equal ground, so they should all be given equal validity. No unifying principle exists, so no unity is possible," close quote. Paul Copan, in his book True for You, But Not for Me, states that pluralism, and I quote, "maintains that no religion can be considered superior to another. To make an exclusive claim is deemed intolerant or arrogant by the pluralist," close quote. So the problem with this philosophy is that since all ideologies and religions are equally legitimate and given equal validity, no ideology or religion can ever be wrong or untrue. That would mean that if you took two truth statements, one from one religion and one from another, and they both contradicted each other, they would both still be true. Now, since there are many ideologies and religions around the world, most of whose truth statements contradict each other, pluralism would argue that all those contradicting truth statements would still be true. Pluralists argue that when it is all said and done, it doesn't matter what you believe, because at the end, all religions will lead all people to the same place, namely heaven. But what about those religions that deny the existence of God or heaven and hell? If their religion is as true as all others, then how will we know where we're going to end up, since many disagree about the existence of God and the existence of a place called heaven? If my claim that God and heaven exist are true, and their claims that God and heaven don't exist are also true, how then do we reconcile these completely opposite statements? Pluralism cannot be true because, among other things, it fails to reconcile the simple fact that two or more contradicting statements about the same subject can't possibly be true. The law of non-contradiction clearly tells us that. Rather than uniting, pluralism ends up dividing, as does relativism. Pluralism ends up being just another self-refuting claim by arguing that, in essence, there's no contradiction in contradicting statements. To say that all ideologies and religions are right and true is obviously untrue. The last philosophy of truth that we will consider is hedonism. Alan Mosley states, and I quote, "Hedonism as a philosophy or worldview measures the rightness or wrongness of a particular course of action by whether it is pleasurable. If it feels good, do it. Do it if it's what you feel, is the contemporary proverb that expresses the philosophy of hedonism. Hedonism formulates this natural tendency into a philosophy of life, an ism, close quote. The philosophies of hedonism and naturalism are philosophies that are closely connected. First of all, hedonism is a result of naturalism. It has a naturalistic view of nature, and as such, it excludes God from nature as naturalism does. When God is excluded, then self is the only one left to whom one has to answer to. Secondly, naturalism is the result of hedonism. When self-pleasure becomes a person's highest good, inevitably, one's worldview will exclude God from it because the very thought of God will hinder one's pursuit of pleasure, close quote. Many of today's venues that promote those self-help, self-fulfillment, personal happiness topics have been heavily influenced by hedonism. There's often no mention of the divine during these types of conferences or in written literature. Again, because the divine hinders the pursuit of that which these proponents are peddling. Many Christians have incorporated hedonism into their personal worldview. When self takes the place of God in one's worldview, then when it comes to worship, who are we worshiping? The answer is quite obvious, self. Hedonism, though, has a number of problems also. First of all, as with all the other isms we have considered, it is a self-refuting argument and philosophy, and as such, it cannot be true. Second, as with all other isms, its ultimate purpose is to remove God from its worldview, thus removing any form of accountability to a divine judge and elevating self to a God status. Third, then there is the hedonistic paradox, as R.C. Sproul refers to it in his book Life Use, Making a Christian Impact on Culture and Society. And here's the paradox. On the one hand, if a hedonist can't reach the level of pleasure sought, frustration sets in, and frustration is pain. On the other hand, if a hedonist does find that pleasure, he will soon become bored with the pleasure itself or the source of that pleasure. Pleasure and the pursuit of pleasure become an addiction. Boredom and addiction also cause pain. Either way, the final outcome for the hedonist is pain. Hedonism, rather than containing the seed of pleasure, as its proponents argue, it contains the seed of pain. Now let's bring into our discussion the subject of intolerance. In this postmodern, relativistic, and pluralistic society we live in, it is not unusual for those who believe in absolute truth to be accused of being intolerant and narrow-minded. Question, are those charges and accusations true? Well, let's consider them a little bit more closely. On the charge of being narrow-minded, there may actually be some truth to that. Not because those who believe in absolute truth are narrow-minded themselves, but because truth is narrow by definition. So for example, if one person states that France is in Asia, while another states that France is in South America, is the person who rejects those statements as being false because he happens to know that France is in Europe narrow-minded? If somebody who knows that 5 plus 5 equals 10 rejects someone else's statement who says that 5 plus 5 equals 7 because he has never studied any math, does that make him narrow-minded? That is nothing more than political correctness run amok. Truth is narrow by definition because it says that if something is true, then its opposite must be false. Also, hypocrisy reigns among those who argue that absolute truth is narrow-minded. Why? Because the ones making those claims are as guilty of being narrow-minded as the people they accuse of being narrow-minded, since their claim is made by using absolute truth statements. I am intolerant and narrow-minded when I say that absolute truth exists. An absolute truth statement, right? But they're not intolerant and narrow-minded when they say truth is relative and there's no such thing as absolute truth. Two absolute truth statements, by the way. Once again, a self-refuting, circular, and hypocritical argument is being used. And finally, just because people, particularly Christians, disagree with worldviews or philosophies about truth other people hold, doesn't mean they are intolerant. By accusing people of intolerance, they prove they don't understand what intolerance means. Intolerance has nothing to do with truth itself. Instead, it has to do with the attitude in which one holds truth. Their accusation confuses what is held, truth, with how it is held, attitude. Truth be told, the only way anybody is going to avoid being accused of being intolerant is to agree with those making the accusation or accusations, to accept their claims. Is that not intolerance? When I disagree with their point of view, I'm intolerant. Yet when they disagree with my point of view, they're not. Do you see the hypocrisy? If I'm intolerant, then they're just as guilty of intolerance as well. Here's another question we need to ask. Is it credible to believe in absolute truth? Well, in light of the arguments presented by the other philosophies about truth, it seems ridiculous to even ask the question of whether it is credible to believe in absolute truth. But we will ask and answer it anyway. People, either consciously or unconsciously, are on a journey in search for truth, for something to believe in. That truth or unchanging reality serves as what we call a fixed point or absolute. That fixed point is what we use to measure our progress in our journey. Consider this. If truth is relative, then you have no fixed point. Without that fixed point, how do we even know we're traveling in the direction we should be traveling in? Well, we won't. The curious thing is that even relativists themselves have a fixed point, even though they would never publicly acknowledge that. What's ironic is that relativists know that truth is not relative. That is precisely why they so fervently argue and propagate their view. Think about it. Why the battle to convince everybody else that relativism is true if they truly believe relativism is true? The point is, relativists would not engage in converting others to become relativists because if they were true relativists, they would know and acknowledge that all worldviews and philosophies about truth are equally valid. But the fact that they do engage in converting people to their point of view and of accusing those who don't convert of intolerance just serves to demonstrate that they believe their view to be superior and truer than all other views. It sure appears that they are behaving just like intolerant absolutists, doesn't it? Joseph Fletcher once wrote, and I quote, "The situationist avoids words like never and perfect and always and complete as he avoids the plague, as he avoids absolutely." Geisler states, and I quote, "What Fletcher is in effect saying is, one should never use the word never, two, one should always avoid using the word always, and three, one should absolutely deny all absolutes." So here's the issue. Denying the existence of absolute violates logic and is self-refuting and self-defeating. Geisler writes, and I quote, "Since it's self-defeating to argue that all views of reality are false or relative, and it's contradictory to believe that all views of reality are true, then the only logical option is to believe that some views represent in a more accurate way reality than others. Therefore, in order for philosophical inquiry to make sense, one is forced to believe in absolute truth. It makes sense to believe that there is a knowable, transcendent, and unchanging reality, a fixed point or referent," close quote. I think it's important to return to the whole idea that these philosophies about truth, rather than uniting, they divide. Alan Mosley says that, and I quote, "Even when people disagree about the truth, they still share common philosophical ground if they at least can agree that truth exists. When the quest for truth is abandoned, every viewpoint, however spurious, is legitimized. So there is no reason to search for consensus under the banner of truth." Close quote. Listen to these sobering words made in the book Relativism, Feet Firmly Planted in Midair, authored by Francis Beckwith and Gregory Kokel. Quote, "Since the 60s, we have been in the throes of this quiet but desperate revolution of thought, the death of truth. We refer to truth of what the late Dr. Francis Schaeffer called true truth, the extinction of the idea that any particular thing can be known for sure. Today, we've lost the confidence that statements of fact can never be anything more than just opinions. We no longer know that anything is certain beyond our subjective preferences. The word truth now means true for me and nothing more. We have entered into an era of dogmatic skepticism. When truth dies, all of its subspecies, such as ethics, perish with it. If truth can't be known, then the concept of moral truth becomes incoherent. Ethics become relative. Right and wrong matters of individual opinion. This may seem a moral liberty, but it ultimately rings hollow. The freedom of our day," lamented a graduate in a Harvard commencement address, "is the freedom to devote ourselves to any values we please, on the mere condition that we do not believe them to be true. The death of truth in our society has created a moral decay in which every debate ends with a barroom question, says who? When we abandon the idea that one set of laws applies to every human being, all that remains is subjective, personal opinion," close quote. How long can a society or civilization survive when the prevailing philosophy about truth is such? Has history taught us nothing? Here's another question. Is Christianity unreasonable as critics claim? They say it is because, according to them, faith contradicts reason. Many believe this, and as a result, we have seen many within the church divorce faith from reason, a concern that many evangelicals have been addressing, such as J.P. Moreland in his book, Love Your God With All Your Mind, and others. This is a charge leveled by those who don't understand how the Bible defines reason and what it says about the relationship between faith and reason. Neither do they know what Orthodox Christianity has historically held and taught concerning this whole issue of faith and reason. Just because they don't understand the relationship between the two doesn't make faith or Christianity unreasonable. If only that which we fully understand is reasonable, then most of what we hold to be true in our lives would have to be labeled as unreasonable. Isn't that unreasonable? God is a rational being, therefore we are rational beings as well, since we are created in His image. There are a number of passages in the Bible that clearly teach us that we are to worship God and bring Him glory through our use of reason. We show God that we love Him by using our minds. For example, Deuteronomy chapter 6, verses 4 and 5 states, "Listen, Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength." And in Matthew chapter 22, verse 37, Jesus said, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind." Faith is unreasonable, they say. But why? Not because faith is unreasonable, but because to them faith is foolishness, just as Paul wrote in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 18, where he states, "For the word of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but it is the power of God to us who are being saved." To prove that faith and reason are inseparable, just consider the doctrine of salvation, the threefold nature of saving faith: knowledge, assent, and trust. The point being, we respond to the gospel through the use of reason, by using our minds. I mean, to the dismay of many who don't understand Christianity, Christianity doesn't call people to exercise the type of faith that requires them to take a blind leap in the dark. That which Christians believe and hold as convictions is supported by an overwhelming amount of evidence. In fact, Christianity throughout the centuries has survived all sorts of scrutiny precisely because it is a reasonable faith. Although it is true that we cannot fully comprehend everything that the Bible teaches, since the finite mind is incapable of comprehending certain mysteries, this does not render faith or Christianity as irrational. Rick Cornish writes, and I quote, "The foundational pillars for thinking, pursuing truth, and acquiring knowledge are the laws of logic. These weren't invented by Aristotle or anyone else. Like gravity, they just are. Reflections of God's reality and the world he made. They govern the way we think, often assumed to be part of our God-given common sense. No moment goes by in which we do not use or assume logic. To deny it requires using it." Close quote. Logic has three interconnected laws. The law of non-contradiction. This law simply states that two contradictory statements about anything cannot be true at the same time and in the same respect. For example, a person cannot smell and not smell at the same time and in the same way. Second, the law of excluded middle. This law states that something either is or is not. It cannot be both at the same time. For example, you are either smelling or not smelling. There is no middle ground, excluded middle. And third, the law of identity. Simply stated, something is either itself or something else. For example, George Washington is George Washington because he cannot be someone else. To be both George Washington and someone else violates the law of identity and is therefore illogical. So, as we explored the various isms, we found a common denominator in all of them. Every single one of those philosophies is a self-refuting philosophy. They self-destruct because the very propositions used to make their claims destroy the claims themselves. Argument is defeated by itself, rendering them all illogical. Well, we have reached the end of this podcast. During our next podcast, we will be considering the Bible's uniqueness. I want to once again thank you for joining us on the program Truth to Live By. This is Dr. Miguel Gonzalez. God bless you.